Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. You might think that the most malevolent contagion of this pervasive pandemic world war has been a reinfestation of the Adolf Hitler virus into the flabby viscera and baleful corpulence of Donald Trump, this platinum anniversary of fetid Nazism's apotheosis in a Berlin bunker. The troglodyte Trump proclaims himself war president, entitled to dispatch American citizens into diseased death for the salvation of Wall Street and his gluttonous lust for cheeseburgers. There seems to be no bottom to his truculent depravity. He literally, in his cruel and abysmal bottomlessness, digs a hole to China. For his willful dare-to-be grotesquery, Americans, one and mostly all, must finally feel a white-hot anger toward Trump and Trumpies, these carrion feeders on slaughtered hopes who would render Earth a mummy ossuary for the fakery of power, wealth, and privileged contempt. We should be angry that we, as a bewildered, frightened, and jaded people, have thrown off our best principles for a diseased dystopia that has been disastrously despotic and disdainful of the democracy it has taken control of through a corrupt electoral campaign. Angry that we have embraced the most banally avaricious premises prescribed by those who are among our nation's most unprincipled and despicable bottom feeders. Angry that those bastardly bottomless mercenaries loot from the poor and bequeath it to the wealthy, and that we who provide the seemingly equally bottomless treasure through taxation and other equally mercenary suborning of emoluments remain anxiously silent or stifled. Angry that we tacitly allow once again the savagery of racial, religious, and sexual discrimination and terror. Angry that so many of us remain mute when our dissolute leaders manipulate us to collude in exploiting the poor people of the world for material idolatries that give us no pleasure or esteem. Angry that we so readily and swiftly retreat into collective amnesia and submit to feigned helplessness and powerlessness inimical to freedom's responsibilities, and that we have pantomimely bow and scrape to moral cowards who brag themselves patriots while draped in swastika banners. Angry that we fight in forever wars that disgrace us as a publicly compassionate people, wars that slaughter the most vulnerable with our sophisticated war technology and primitive political purposes. Angry that veterans return virtually unnoticed from war, sick in body, tormented in mind, shoved aside to be unseen and unheard to not disturb forever warfare. Angry that we descendants of revolutionaries descend into dictatorial tyranny. Angry that we betray our descendants by dispossessing the unborn. Angry that once again free and independent women and men who declare opposition to inappropriate tyranny and terror are increasingly branded traitors and enemies of the state, quote unquote. Angry that the sick and dead of this pandemic plague are manipulated in a body count farce reminiscent of the Vietnam atrocity to fit the narcissist neo-Nazism of the venomous disgrace of a single human being whose only empathy is for himself and the power he craves to remain as president of these continually disunited states of America, with a K. And perhaps we should be angriest of all that with the still inexplicable rise of Trump, the persistent question remains. Do the values of democracy paralyze us to its flagrant electoral coup and virtual collapse by a malevolent, psychopathically avaricious, and narcissistic tyrant who demands deceit and, perfidious duplicity over truth and honesty as the governing principles of his virulent cabal, who have proven beyond any doubt they are unfit to represent democracy. This loathsome boll weevil of a president, despite his despicably dishonest claim as a uniter, has functioned solely as a divider who sets everybody at everybody else's throat. We ought to be especially provoked that he demands the noblesse oblige of a king when he is only a president, and a fraudulent one, who acts belligerently unconcerned about the human toll of a murderous disease that is killing thousands of Americans, obsessively concerned only with a devastated economy and his re-election as president, which he has often threatened to not relinquish if not re-elected, as if such a prospect would be proof of a fraudulently rigged voting process. It is quite possible that the presidency as an all-powerful unitary executive, a fallacious concept Trump has purloined from G.W. Bush, has lost much of its veneer and presumptive power it has accumulated over the last several decades, its stark stupidity proved by Trump himself, and that the Constitution is, in a sense, rectifying itself. And that was something I wrote, more or less untitled, unless you simply want to call it anger. And now, from Timothy Egan, who is a New York Times correspondent and lifelong Pacific Northwest resident, an article he wrote for the Times. The world is taking pity on us. Will American prestige ever recover? In 1847, members of the Choctaw Nation sent relief money across the Atlantic to a starving Ireland, something the Irish, who lost more than a million people in a famine made worse by British indifference, have never forgotten. The Irish are now giving financial aid to Native American tribes hit with a pandemic that has been made worse by American incompetence. This is a gracious act, a boomerang of goodwill, as reported by my colleagues Ed O'Loughlin and Mihir Zaveri. But it also shows how much of the world has started to feel sorry for a nation laid low by the lethal ineptitude of President Trump. The country Trump promised to make great again has never in its history seemed so pitiful, wrote Fintan O'Toole in the Irish Times. And he asked, will American prestige ever recover from this shameful episode? Before we take up O'Toole's question, let's look at where we rank in the worst global crisis since World War II. In Trump's assessment, his government has done a spectacular job, quote unquote, with the COVID-19 pandemic. And I'll tell you, the whole world is excited watching us because we're leading the world, he said in an updated pat on the back this past week. He's right about the leading part. Every 49 seconds or so, throughout the first week in May, an American has been dying of this disease. With 1.3 million reported cases, the United States, just 5% of the world's population, has nearly 33% of the sick. With more than 75,000 deaths, we're at the front of the pack as well. No country comes close on all three measures. Globally, the average death rate is 34 people per million residents. In the United States, it's more than six times higher, 232 per million. South Korea and the United States both reported their first cases of COVID-19 at the same time, in the third week of January. South Korea immediately started testing on a mass scale and socially isolating. The United States denied, dithered, and did next to nothing for more than 2 months. By the end of April, new cases in South Korea were down to less than 10 a day. In the United States at that time, the pandemic raged at a daily rate of more than 25,000 newly sick. New Zealand, which also quickly went into lockdown, reported no new cases earlier this past week for the first time since mid-March. The United States reacted like Pakistan or Belarus, like a country with shoddy infrastructure and a dysfunctional government whose leaders were too corrupt or stupid to head off mass suffering. And that's a quote, an indictment of the Atlantic's George Packer, calling the United States a failed state. He's half right. As scientists note, you can't stop an outbreak from happening, but you can stop it from becoming a catastrophe that brings down a society. The United States spends more on health care per capita than any other rich nation. And yet, here we are, a full-blown disaster in lockdown with a narcissist for a president. A country that turned out 8 combat aircraft every hour at the peak of World War II could not even produce enough 75-cent masks or simple cotton nasal swabs for testing this pandemic. A country that showed the world how to defeat polio now promotes quack remedies involving household disinfectants from the presidential podium. A country that rescued post-war Europe with the Marshall Plan didn't even bother to show up at the teleconference of global leaders pledging contributions for a coronavirus vaccine last week. A country that sent George Patton and Dwight Eisenhower to crush the Nazis now fights a war against a viral killer with Jared Kushner, a feckless, failed real estate speculator who holds power by virtue of his marriage to the president's daughter. Let's not put too much of the blame on Kushner. After all, he's also got Middle East peace, the border wall, the opioid crisis, and reinventing the government on his plate. Who's in charge of it? Trump said recently about the Warp Speed vaccine development program. Honestly, I am. I'll tell you, I'm really in charge of it. Well then, where is the test and trace program needed to safely reopen the country? Where is the national plan to even consider such an effort? Trump has surrendered. He never looked smaller or more pathetic than when sitting 2 Sundays ago or so on his little chair in front of the Lincoln Memorial. America has a failed federal government, laughed at and pitied the world over. But America is not a failed state. It will be saved by its scientists and doctors, its hospitals and universities, its nimble and creative companies, and leaders in the state houses who act more decisively than the family of frauds in the White House. Perhaps it is best to let the coronavirus task force die a miserable death. It's mostly show and ego projection. As to the Irishman's question, will American prestige ever recover? Not for some time. Our image abroad took a real hit after Trump's election, and it has continued to fall. Most of the world now has no confidence in the president's leadership. But then, the same is true with most Americans. Welcome to our nightmare. And that was The World is Taking Pity on Us by Timothy Egan, who is a contributing opinion writer to the Times and has written several very good books, mostly about the Pacific Northwest, The Worst Hard Time, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America, et al. He won the Pulitzer Prize for National Reporting for a series which the New York Times shared in How Race is Lived in America. And he lives in Seattle. And now, from Robert Brake of Ocean Park, Washington, The War on Voting. I proudly display a bumper sticker that reads, "I'm voting, are you?" But alas, over the past 5 decades, millions of American workers have been disenfranchised, stripped of their constitutionally sanctioned right to vote. Because our votes determine who runs our government and what policies are employed, the vote stands as the single most important part of the commons, above even government itself. The term commons denotes cultural and natural resources accessible to all Americans, resources held in common, not privately owned. As Thomas Paine remarked, the right of voting for representatives is the primary right which other rights are protected. To take away the right is to reduce a man to slavery. And that was Thomas Paine. Today in the United States, there is a concerted, well-organized campaign to prevent some people from voting, as evident in the April 7th, 2020 Wisconsin primary fiasco, while making it more and more convenient for others. At the core of this effort are the think tanks, media, publications, pundits, and politicians entirely owned or heavily influenced by a relatively small group of billionaires and corporations whose wealth depends on despoiling and exploiting the commons for profit. This group, operating loosely under the rubric of the Republican Party, has worked since the 1970s to deceive people into thinking that poorly paying non-union jobs represent freedom, that lack of health care is freedom, that protection of the environment is despicable regulation, and that people working to encourage others to participate in our democracy by voting are engaging in voter fraud and should be harassed or prosecuted out of existence. The voter fraud ploy is particularly disingenuous. The December 1st, 2016 issue of the Washington Post noted that of the 135 million votes cast, just 4 confirmed instances were identified. Apparently, President Donald Trump was a bit amiss, and that's a quote, when he insisted that 3 million California voters had cast fraudulent ballots in 2016. The suppression battle was apparently seeded in 1971 when Lewis Powell, a year before Richard Nixon put him on the Supreme Court, wrote an infamous memo to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, imploring the very wealthy to get politically active. Powell explicitly called for a vigorous effort to take over the court system of America, which he believed was being used too often against business and the rich by environmentalists and consumer activists like Ralph Nader. Powell's memo activated a group of previously disparate conservatives and their foundations to go into hyperdrive. Recall that in 2016, just 6% of Americans who were eligible to vote nominated Donald Trump as the GOP presidential candidate. It was 8% for Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton. Trump went on to be elected president by 26% of eligible voters. It is important to remember that modern American oligarchs have stayed in power using 3 simple elements: explicit, overt racism, massive disinformation campaigns, and voter suppression. No ideas, no push for better schools, hospitals, airports, roads, or bridges, or reform of our health, energy, or financial systems, and no promise of more and better jobs. None of those staples of past presidential campaigns can be found in pretty much any Republican advertising today. Indeed, the constant public Republican message is all about race. One way or another, it's also about religion. Muslim stands for brown Arab in GOP speak, and immigration, aka brown people from south of our border, and socialism. Meanwhile, Republican secretaries of state across the country vigorously purge voters from the rolls. Over 17 million, more than 10% of America's active voters, in the 2016 to 2018 period, according to an October 23, 2018 NBC News report. After the 5 Republican appointees on the U.S. Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act in 2013, 14 GOP-controlled states moved within a year, some within days, to restrict access to the vote, particularly for communities of color, students, and retired people. By 2016, the Republican Party had fine-tuned its voter suppression and intimidation systems to the point that they ran like well-oiled machines in nearly 30 states. For example, between the 2012 and 2016 presidential elections, Ohio purged more than 2 million voters from its rolls, the majority in heavily African-American and Hispanic communities. Other states have since adopted a new tactic of K caging voters, challenging their registration status by mailing them postcards and then striking them from the voter rolls if the postcards weren't returned. It's truly symbiotic. Billionaires and corporations are spending hundreds of millions to fund Republicans who pass laws and tax breaks that give billions to corporations and billionaires who then recycle a fraction of that, mere millions, back to the legislatures they own. To keep the cycle going, corporations and billionaires must prevent people who object to that system from voting. Average Americans, of course, generally don't like billionaires and corporations who run politics. So the billionaires and their corporations have organized major efforts to keep those people from voting. How many people? The numbers are sketchy because Republican secretaries of state are unwilling to release purge numbers and details without being sued to do so. Echoing some of our current progressive politicians, Benjamin Franklin felt that the vote should be more widely available, regardless of wealth or property ownership. Thomas Paine agreed with Franklin, going further to vilify the wealthy landowners of his time who didn't want non-landowners to vote. "Wealth is no proof of moral character," he wrote. He added, "Wealth is often the presumptive evidence of dishonesty, and poverty the negative evidence of innocence." Furthermore, Paine concluded, the proposal to disenfranchise any class of men, and you can add women since, is as criminal as the proposal to take away property. Where are we today, then? The GOP's war on voting since the early 1970s is fundamentally about seizing control of government and thus the commons, turning both into private profit machines, regardless of the consequences for we the people. And that was Robert Brake, The War on Voting. And he lives and writes in Ocean Park, Washington. And now, something that I have written, sort of as epilogue. While we who dwell on the Oregon and Washington North Pacific coasts earnestly await the once every three centuries massive earthquake and tsunami, a reminder that we are also rimmed by a volatile range of volcanic mountains will be the 40th anniversary on May 18th of the eruption of Mount St. Helens. The prettiest mountain in the Pacific Northwest, nearly a perfect cone like Japan's mystical Mount Fuji, and usually ice creamy with snow, erupted in an explosion tantamount to a thermonuclear blast on May 18, 1980. At least 60 people died in that incredible eruption. Thousands of animals were killed. Forests were obliterated. Spirit Lake disappeared. Mudslides and log jams flooded the Toutle River and collapsed several bridges. The Columbia River Channel had to be dredged because mud washed downriver blocked ships. Eastern Washington was covered with volcanic ash as far as Spokane, and pumice littered ocean beaches, which dentists claimed to be of better quality than the gold standard pumice from Mount Vesuvius, a famously ancient eruption of which instantly buried the Roman cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum in hot lava flows in 79 AD. Millions of tons of dust from Mount St. Helens was hurled into the sky, and it was initially thought a ring of dirt and smoke would form around Earth and block sunlight, as happened when Krakatoa Mountain erupted in the Indian Ocean in 1883. That eruption also caused a giant tsunami that inflicted much damage and loss of life on the coasts of Java and Sumatra. Such a tsunami is expected to occur as an adjunct to the predicted major earthquake that will shake, rattle, and roll the Oregon and Washington coasts anytime soon. Portland poet Walt Curtis, long considered as Oregon's unofficial poet laureate, wrote that an original people of the Northwest, the Klickitat tribe, considered Mount St. Helens as Lewit, the Snow Witch, though its current name is that of a former English lord. uneasy magic has always been associated with St. Helens, Curtis wrote. Miners in the 1920s claimed they were attacked on the mountain by a family of Sasquatch. Another legendary figure associated with Mount St. Helens was Harry Truman, a World War I veteran who operated the Spirit Lake Lodge for half a century and became a folk hero who refused to leave the mountain when it first began to rumble early in 1980 and died in the May 8th eruption. In the future, he might be confused with his namesake, the 33rd President of the USA, also a World War I vet, but he will most likely be mythologized into local folklore as Oregon artist, USMC Vietnam War veteran, and buckskin-clad black powder musketeer William Michael Schuster etched him in pen and ink, his smoke-wreathed head exploding out of the disintegrating face of Mount St. Helens, eternally converged with the mountain. Every time I look to the north at the spectacular scenery of the snow-capped peaks of the Cascades, known as the Ring of Fire, Walt Curtis wrote, I see one decapitated natural shrine leveled by a cosmic bulldozer. And today, 224 years ago, on May 14, 1796, English country doctor Edward Jenner administered what is considered the world's first true vaccination as a preventive treatment for smallpox, which had killed millions of people all over planet Earth for centuries. He took fluid from a cowpox blister and scratched it into the skin of an 8-year-old boy named James Fitz, who soon recovered. On July 1st that year, he inoculated the boy again, this time with smallpox matter, and no disease developed. Doctors throughout Europe quickly adopted Jenner's vaccination technique, which drastically curtailed smallpox, which was finally eradicated in the late 20th century, although some suspicious conspiracy advocates suspect batches of the smallpox venom remain secretly contained in a few national biochemical arsenals. Perhaps some of these same doubters think the coronavirus was manufactured in a Chinese lab, as Trump and Pompeo ardently claim to focus away from Trump's absurd and deceitful incompetence. And this is Michael McCusker. Stay safe. Protecting yourself protects everyone else. No matter how restless, impatient, or bored you might feel under house arrest, don't forget that death is forever.